I'm Marty Moscoe. Welcome to Radio Times. 10 years ago, Tarana Burke was living in Philadelphia and created the hashtag MeToo on her MySpace page to raise awareness about harassment and the sexual assault of women and to tell them and others that they are not alone. While MySpace has been supplanted by other more popular online sites, her hashtag has gone viral, used by women to share their stories about sexual predators. There have been millions of posts on Facebook and Twitter in recent weeks after revelations about Harvey Weinstein. While the high-profile cases have involved public figures in Hollywood and broadcasting, most harassment and assault will rarely make the news. Today on Radio Times, the Me Too campaign and what to do about harassment and sexual assault on the street, at work, and in life. We have three guests who have joined us, two of whom are here in our Philadelphia studio. Lisa Huebner is a feminist sociologist of gender, also associate professor in the Department of Women's and Gender Studies at Westchester University, wrote a book a couple of years ago, Catheters, Slurs, and Pickup Lines, Professional Intimacy and Hospital Nursing. Lisa Huebner, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thank you. So happy to be here.
Nice to have you with us. Also with us here in our Philadelphia studio is Noella Cabral. She's an educator, an activist, an award-winning filmmaker, active in the movement to teach consent and to end gender-based violence. She is affiliated with Temple University, works with high school students, and for a while was a board member of the nonprofit Stop Street Harassment. Noella, nice to have you with us on Radio Times as well.
Thank you. Nice to be here.
Nice to have you with us. And joining us by Skype is Jacqueline Friedman. She's an educator and an activist. She's the author of three books about sexual culture in America, including Yes Means Yes, and her latest, Unscrewed, Women's Sex Power and How to Stop Letting the System Screw Us All. Jacqueline Friedman, nice to have you with us on Radio Times as well.
Glad to be here.
And to our listeners, the lines are open at 1-888-477-9499. We want your story. You can also send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. So where to start? Let me start with you, Lisa, but I want to hear from you, Jacqueline, and you, Noella, as well. Are we at some kind of a turning point with this Me Too campaign or Me Too hashtag?
I think we are. I've been thinking about this a lot, just even watching it occur in my own personal life and then certainly talking to folks about it. And I feel like it's, while it's reminiscent of consciousness raising activities that have been happening for decades between and among women, and even the purpose of the, you know, hashtag Me Too was to make sure that we as survivors are talking to each other. I do think that we're in a moment that's amplifying this call and, you know, this call to action, if you will. And It's interesting, it's exciting, and I think we need to pay attention.
How about for you, Noella? How do you see it?
I think we keep seeing every few years there's these opportunities for these conversations. And I do think that oftentimes it does take someone famous, you know, for it to happen to someone famous for us to pay attention. But I think it's important to remember that a lot of this this advocacy work is happening on the ground all the time. And so I do think that this is an opportunity for us to continue to amplify and to demand accountability.
And Jacqueline, this particular hashtag is 10 years old. Nonetheless, it has just truly gone viral in the last couple of weeks. How do you see this?
I mean, it's undeniably powerful. And I think anytime you see women telling their stories and being believed around sexual violence, it's a good thing. And it helps other survivors to know that their stories will also be taken seriously and what was done to them is not okay. I'm not sure I know in advance if it's a turning point or not. You know, I feel like I get asked that question every time there's one of these news cycles, when Bill Cosby happened, when Elliot Rodgers, when Gian Gomeshi, and, you know, the list goes on. And it's hard to ignore the fact that the last time we had this conversation was about a year ago, and it was about Donald Trump. And he, in fact, faced not only no consequences for the dozen sexual assault allegations that have been made against him and him confessing on tape, he was elected president of the United States. And I think actually some outrage about that in communities of survivors is fueling this moment, you know, that there has to be some accountability somewhere.
Well, picking up on that, Jacqueline, and going back to you, what then would make the difference? I'm thinking of Anita Hill. I mean, there are many stories and examples that we can talk about in the past, but what would make a difference, do you think?
Well, I think each one of these moments does make a difference. It's just not a dramatic turning point, any individual one of them. I mean, Anita Hill made a huge difference. She was the moment for me. You know, I had been sexually harassed as an 18, 19-year-old and didn't have any language for it, really didn't have any context for it. It was treated by everyone around me like it was the weather. It was just something that was going to happen, and you had to figure out how to work around it. And for her to step up and say, not only was this not okay, not only is this in fact illegal and there's a name for it, I think that it should prevent someone from being a Supreme Court justice. That's how serious it is. That was transformative for me, and it was transformative for a lot of people. We saw reports the EEOC double and triple in the years after she came forward. So these moments absolutely matter. But I think that progress is just is more incremental than we wish it were.
How about for you, Lisa? Picking up on that.
Yeah, I think that the difference this time, while I agree with much of what Jacqueline's saying, I think the difference this time is that we are seeing individuals that we know in our social media making the decision to come out and say hashtag me too, and what that means. Because unfortunately, despite, you know, how often this happens and that we have decades now of research and advocacy, and I love what you said, Nuella, about how it's always happening, right? We're always advocating. We don't get the attention, but now we have a sequence, a chain, if you will, of individuals coming out. And I think, to me, that's part of the difference. For me, my turning point was actually working as a waitress in high school. So, you know, and seeing how the older women who were what I might consider career waitresses were constantly being sexually harassed in a way that was different than my sexual harassment. So I think we each have our turning points, and we each see how it happens and when. And what's interesting is how individuals, and we see, you know, I see people from high school who are doing this. I mean, I'm 47, right? And who are just coming out and saying these. And I think that makes a difference.
Well, you talked about the fact that when celebrities talk about things, people do pay attention. And we have talked in the past about Harvey Weinstein and some of these more high-profile cases. Nonetheless, there was a lot of denial. I mean, what we're learning in particular about Harvey Weinstein was that a lot of people knew what was going on, or they put up with it, or they observed it, or they even enabled it in certain ways. Speaking more broadly, does that tell us something about our culture?
I think it points to our rape culture in this society. This is a rape culture. It allows rape and sexual violence to flourish unchecked. It perpetuates silence. It perpetuates victim blaming, and that's why it's so important to teach consent. It's we have a lot of work to do.
We do.
This definitely is an opportunity. I agree. Where it's an opportunity for people to gain empathy and to come forward and hopefully feel supported and reminded that they're not alone.
Jacqueline, you wrote a book called Yes Means Yes, which is different from No Means No. This issue of consent, let's fold that into our conversation. How does that, and I'm also thinking of some of the work you're doing, Noella, having to do with street harassment, but help us understand what consent really means, Jacqueline.
Real consent means that we're concerned with our sexual partners or anyone we want to interact with sexually, that we treat them as fully equal human beings, right? Ultimately, that's what it's about. So affirmative consent, yes means yes, means that if you want to do anything sexual with a person, you have to make sure that they're actually into it and not just not objecting, which is no means no. And that removes the onus on sort of, oh, did she object hard enough? Or, you know, sometimes victims will freeze. You know, sometimes people will feel afraid. So there's a lot of room, if you just apply no means no, for a lot of violence. Yes means yes puts the onus on each of us as actors to make sure we're not hurting anybody. And most of us who are decent human beings don't want to. So it's just a set of tools and a conversation to help us do what we want to do anyway, which is not hurt anybody. So But ultimately, when we apply this to sort of workplace conversations, it's really about seeing women as fully human, right? Like sometimes when I
talk
about...
What a revelation.
I know. Sometimes when I talk about affirmative consent, I hear from men who say that I'm trying to criminalize male heterosexuality. And, you know, to which I tend to respond, like, if that's your idea of what male heterosexuality is, like, mm-hmm. that's something you need to look at, right? That male heterosexuality relies on being able to act upon women without their consent. And that's what we're seeing in the Weinstein case and in a lot of the stories we're hearing on the Me Too hashtag, is just stories of women who encountered almost universally, although not universally, men who don't think of them as full humans, who think of them as props or objects for them to, you know, use as they please. And so changing the conversation around consent really is about changing the conversation about, you know, women being subjects of our own bodies and our own sexuality and not objects.
Let me turn back to you, Noelle. I'm thinking about the Stop Street Harassment campaign. You were a board member for a while. They did a survey a couple of years ago, found that 65% of women in the United States said they experienced street harassment. 23% of American women said they had been touched. 20% had been following. And among men, about 25% said that they had been harassed on the street as well. Mm-hmm. We think of street harassment as kind of a nuisance kind of thing. You did a really interesting video about what it means to walk on the street and be left alone. Can you speak to that?
Yeah, I made a film called Walking Home. It's available on YouTube. It's 4 minutes. And it was basically inspired by growing up in my 20s in different cities across the East Coast and realizing that street harassment was happening in every city, but the ways in which I felt comfortable responding to it changed, and that I noticed that in a matter of seconds, women are making decisions around what is the safest response. So we're factoring in, okay, what time of day is it? What kind of shoes am I wearing? Is there anyone around? Is this person mentally unstable? All of these things, you know, does this person have a bottle in their hand? All of these things we factor in our head about to decide what is the safest response. And what I found was that, you know, what I had been told and many folks are told growing up, which is ignore it, you know, boys will be boys, that kind of thing, that actually isn't always the safest response, right? And so it fascinated me, it disturbed me, and I made a film about it, put it online, and it connected me to a movement that I wasn't even aware of, which was the beginning of this global anti-street harassment movement. And so Stop Street Harassment is an organization, along with Hollaback and many others, that are working to raise awareness around gender-based street harassment. And I think it's important to note that street harassment isn't an issue that only affects cis women, but also affects non-gender conforming folks and a lot of LGBT folks. And oftentimes research shows that when it does happen to those communities, it is even more aggressive and escalates to violence more quickly.
I want to pick up on all of that. Hold your thought, only because we have to take a very short break. That's Noelle Cabral. Also with us, Jacqueline Friedman and Lisa Huebner. We are talking about the Me Too campaign, the hashtag Me Too. I should add, it began here in Philadelphia 10 years ago and now is an international phenomenon. We want to have you join our conversation. That phone number is 1-888-477-9499. Stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoane. Just a recap here. We are talking about the Me Too campaign that has gone viral. Millions of posts on Facebook and Twitter having to do with stories, allegations of harassment and sexual assault. And our guests are Lisa Huebner. She's a professor, associate professor in the Department of Women's and Gender Studies at Westchester University, just outside of Philadelphia, wrote a book called Catheters, Slurs, and Pickup Lines. Jacqueline Friedman joining us by Skype. She's an educator, an author, and an activist as well. Her most recent book is Unscrewed. And Noelle Cabral is an educator, activist, award-winning filmmaker. She works at Temple University in a movement to teach consent and to end gender-based violence. And again, you can join our conversation by calling us at 1-888-477-9499. You can also email us, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times to join the conversation. Let me get Claire from Orland to join us. Claire, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi.
Hi there.
Good morning. Thank you.
Sure.
It's so so coincidental that your show is about sexual harassment, because just this morning, my daughter, who lives and works in Philadelphia, she's 27 years old, is on the bus on her way to work, and a man sat next to her with a big bag, and he kind of wedged it between himself and the end of his seat so that he was sitting really close to her, and started to talk to her and ask her for her number. She kept telling him, no, I'm not interested. Please stop. You're making me uncomfortable. He would not stop. So she just got up and went to the front of the bus and got off at her stop and was just really creeped out about it. But, you know, she was kind of in a tough spot because he had a big bag. She didn't know what could have been in the bag if she got a little bit more assertive with him. Would anyone help her if she got assertive? And this man became violent. So yeah. I'm just very angry myself as her mom.
Sure you are.
So helpless.
Well, I'm really...
And I know that this... Yeah.
No, I'm really glad you called in. I'm really glad you called in because in many ways, as I said, the, you know, it's the big famous and obviously shocking stories are the ones that make the news. But these are the day-to-day things that happen. Do you want to respond, Lisa?
Sure. Thank you so much for calling in. I mean, I guess what I'm thinking about right now is how this is what keeps the silence about these issues, is that it seems to us that it's really blurry between, oh, I'm just getting to know you, and harassment. You know, what actually is harassment?
Being friendly, right?
Right. But the friendliness, and Jacqueline referred to this earlier, you know, the quote-unquote friendliness is just really the way we teach men how to be men. I mean, why are we suggesting that, you know, men should be able to just access more space and access more time, you know, and not really consider being polite and reading body cues? And, you know, so if this really was just about communication, then those would occur. This is more about entitlement. And I'm also interested in thinking about how your daughter was, you know, worried about how he might escalate. And that, in fact, is a dynamic that we see over and over again in cases of sexual harassment, in cases of power-based violence, right? So the escalation or the fear of escalation is a big dynamic there.
Noella, let me go back to you, and Jacqueline, I'll make sure you're in on the conversation as well. But I'm thinking about, this is, a variation of one of those street interactions. Mm-hmm. And I think when we think of harassment, it's mostly just saying things, but it's obviously much more than that. It can be following a woman or sometimes, as you say, a man, touching them, things that really verge into what would be called assault. But I also notice that these incidents tend to happen when men are in groups. Yes. It doesn't happen as much when it's a man by himself.
It depends. It's a range.
It's a range.
Unfortunately, thank you for the caller. And I'm really sorry this happened to your daughter. And unfortunately, this is actually a typical experience in Philadelphia. Many girls experience this kind of harassment on a daily basis on their way to school. Women and trans and non-gender conforming folks are experiencing this on their daily work commute. And we need, this is why it's so important, we need people to be talking about this. We need bystanders to speak up. There's no reason why your daughter should be on that bus and be so uncomfortable with all these people around and no one saying anything. Right. She should be able to go to the bus driver and tell the bus driver what's going on, and they should be able to throw that person off the bus. I'm not a strong advocate for increasing the criminalization of street harassment. I think that there are other ways that that we can solve this problem, but I think overall there just has to be this sense of accountability, community accountability, and we just can't tolerate this as, you know, just a typical nuisance.
Jacqueline, what are your thoughts? And I'm even thinking about what you know each situation obviously is different, but what are some of the options that someone would have when faced with some level of public harassment?
Well, I just want to say I'm angry, too.
You're angry, too. Yeah.
Fuming about it right now. you know, I think that your daughter did what she could. You know, I think that the options we should be talking about are the options for bystanders and people in positions of power, right? What we don't need is more safety tips for women or people who feel like they might be vulnerable in public to this kind of harassment. The world has been full of those for decades and decades, and it has not addressed the problem. You know, and what... That what I'm this case, this sort of story reminds me of sort of my sort of asterisk or my hesitation to say that this Me Too campaign is going to be a giant turning point, because while it's great that Harvey Weinstein and a few other powerful men have been called to account in this recent news cycle, most people who faced sexual harassment or abuse have never seen any accountability for the people who hurt them, any kind of accountability. And so for survivors of that kind of harassment and abuse, most of us are sitting here thinking, that's great. Like, it is great to see Harvey Weinstein have faced some accountability, but nothing happened to the guy who hurt me, right? Like, and nobody stood up for this girl on a bus, right? Like, nobody stood up for her. So, you know, what we need to really move the conversation forward isn't just the testimony of survivors, although I do think that's useful for a lot of reasons, but what we need is a conversation about how to make a bystander culture, an intervention culture, and also, again, a culture where people don't see sexual dominance as a viable social strategy.
And as Jacqueline was talking, Lisa, I scribbled the word bystander. That's such an important and powerful role that someone can play when they do intervene.
Right.
I mean, it requires crossing over some almost invisible boundaries, but can have a powerful effect.
Right. I mean, I think one of the differences that we've seen in the past 10 years or so is really the emergence of bystander programs on college campuses, in high schools, everywhere. And, you know, you can be any gender identity and be a bystander. And so there actually are tips, right, on how to do that. I think part of the conversation has to be how we redefine masculinity. Because I agree, we need to put the onus on the behavior, right? So it is toxic to define how to be a man, you know, by being harmful and invasive to women. And I, you know, sociologist Michael Kimmel talks a lot about how this kind of harassment, street harassment in particular, happening in groups of men is just a way for them to build each other up. And so we need to teach men and boys, and really people of all gender identity, that masculinity can be healthy and not be toxic.
Let me see what Sarah from Malaga, I never know, Malaga, New Jersey, has to say. Sarah, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi. I just, when the campaign, the Me Too campaign, really took force, I thought a lot about how, as a woman, on an almost daily basis, I have to question where I go, and do I stop going places? For example, the gym, after receiving persistent sexual advances from men, and leaving the gym uncomfortable and thinking to myself, do I go back to the gym? Do I wear different clothes to the gym? Do I go to the gym at a different time? Do I stop taking these classes? And that happens in a lot of other places besides the gym. And for that reason, I think that it would you'd be hard-pressed to find a woman who hasn't at some point or another been faced with sexual harassment.
Well, and Noella, what we're hearing from Sarah is that she's got to make all these decisions, right, to navigate around a situation that's uncomfortable and maybe more threatening.
Yeah. Yeah, and you're not alone. And it's not okay. And I think that's why it's so important. We're talking about bystanders. It's so important to teach consent. The work that I've been doing with Temple students from the University Community Collaborative is going into high schools in Philadelphia and teaching about consent, teaching about safe ways to intervene. Because one of the things that, you know, a lot of times the boys will say is, oh, well, if I don't know her, I'm not saying anything because I'm not going to get jumped, you know, or worse, for sticking up for someone I don't even know. So we talk about, okay, well, what are some strategies to intervene in a way that is going to keep you safe? And also keep the person who's being harassed safe.
So what are some of those strategies?
So one of the things we talk about is, well, there's a couple different people you could engage in when you're seeing street harassment or unwanted attention in public space happening. You could talk to the perpetrator. You could talk to the person who's being harassed. You could talk to other bystanders. You could talk to someone else who's in charge or, you know, has some kind of authority in the area. And you could use humor. You could use distraction. You could, if you don't feel comfortable engaging with a person who's being who's doing the harassing, you could just stick around and keep be physically close and make eye contact with the person who's being harassed, just to let them know, hey, you're not alone, and I see what's going on. And then when it finishes, going up to that person and saying, hey, I'm sorry that was happening to you. Are you okay? Do you want me to walk with you somewhere? You know, sometimes we've had boys in classrooms say that they pretend like they know the person who's being harassed. And that's a strategy.
And that's a strategy. You're nodding your head, Lisa, very enthusiastically as Noella's talking.
Just because I want to underscore everything she said. I mean, ditto, ditto, ditto. That's what we do at Westchester University. Our campus center for women and gender equity is training students on just those things, the distractions, the interruptions, the using of humor, the spilling the drink, anything to sort of interrupt the moment.
What do you think, Jacqueline?
I mean, yeah, I don't know that I have anything productive to add.
That's okay.
The one thing that I will add, actually, is I worked, I guess a few years ago now, with a whole bunch of fraternity groups at Indiana University at Bloomington, and one thing that I heard from one of them is that they had a meeting in the beginning of the year with this one fraternity, and they said to each other, like, these are our values. These are kind of people we want to be. When we're hosting a party, we're going to set a code. It was like a sentence you might say to a friend, but it was a specific sentence, like, hey, do you want a particular drink? Or I don't remember what it was. And it was a way that if you saw your friend behaving in a way that you thought was crossing a line in some way, you could kind of call him in without embarrassing him in front of everybody and making a confrontational scene. So one thing that I definitely advise, on top of all the great advice that Noella and Lisa have outlined, is plan ahead. And in fact, you can have these conversations in your friend groups about, if we see something, what do we as a group want to do and what are our strategies going to be?
I mean, it sounds like a variant on a safe word or something like that. Looks like Dave from Maple Glen to join us. Hi, Dave. Go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi, Marty.
Hi there.
Great show.
Thanks.
My daughter spent 5 years as a high school math teacher in inner city Brooklyn in a Hispanic neighborhood, and she caught a lot of this harassment going to and from her job. And what she did, what really successfully, she said, she's a pretty tough girl. This was when she was in her late 20s. If she was in a crowded situation, like just generally walking across the street or walking down the sidewalk in the neighborhood during the day, and someone called her out and, harassed her physically, which is really common in Hispanic neighborhoods, she turned right around and she would say, shame on you. Would you want someone saying that to your sister? Or if it was a younger kid, to your mother? And not only did they often apologize to her, but they would be ragged on by the women on the street who would follow up what my daughter would say. And she said it was a really successful strategy for, assuming people were around and it was daytime.
Sure, Dave. I appreciate the call to Radio Times. I'm not sure it's more common in Hispanic neighborhoods than any other kind of neighborhood. But Noella, do you want to respond to that?
Yeah, I think it's important to note that street harassment happens everywhere. I think especially for those of us who are not, you don't have the luxury of having a car, like, and you're in the city, you're going to engage with more people on the street. Sexual harassment, when you're in, fancy suburbs, it still happens. It's just not happening on the street. It's happening in other ways, maybe in offices and other spaces. But yeah, we do want to be careful. I do think that we learn how to respond as we get older, and there are ways that I now feel comfortable responding that I wouldn't have felt responding that way when I was 20. And so when I have these conversations, particularly with young women, I say, the safest response is, or the best response, because they always ask, what's the best response? The best response is what the safest response is for you. And
at that moment
and time for you. And so I can't tell you what that is.
Oh, but here obviously are some options.
Yes.
And Dave's daughter was pretty outspoken. Mm-hmm. Lisa, you want to comment on that?
I just also want to underscore how important it is to talk about this phenomenon, both as happening all the time, everywhere, in all kinds of neighborhoods, in all racial populations, but also to be clear that there are racial dynamics involved. So, for example, in the nurses that I interviewed, the nurses who were women of color experienced a very distinct kind of sexual harassment that was informed by both racism and sexism at the same time. Mm-hmm. That is not often caught in generalized, universalized discussions of sexual harassment. So when I talk about race, I'm usually talking about what that means for survivors. And I think that's important to consider how those dynamics also fuel and merge together to create what we might not even consider as sexual harassment when we think about it in the law. So that's one thing. And then certainly when you look at conviction rates, who gets the less, like the lowest amount of convictions mm-hmm. are white male perpetrators. Mm-hmm. So race plays a big part, but I would absolutely disagree that it happens more in Hispanic neighborhoods.
Fair enough, fair enough. And we should add, just to add to our conversation, I mean, people have the right to say things in public, whether we like them or not. So that's where it obviously gets complicated. We don't have time, really, Lisa, to do justice to your book, but you do look at a very specific profession. This is nursing. Not so much anymore considered a female profession. Obviously, that's very different today. But there is this intimacy between a nurse and a patient, and also this power differential between the nurse and the doctor. In 60 seconds, can you do justice to that?
Sure. One of the things that I found most interesting is that many people ask about how doctors harass nurses. But what I found is that patients do it, and family members do it just as much, if not more, and that's under the radar because of the way we need to care for patients. So the question is, how is managing these interactions a part of the job? And that really mirrors some of what we've already mm-hmm. said, and how often these interactions, these harassments, are almost seen as mundane, ordinary, and are not captured by the law. Street harassment is not captured by the law, and so we cannot count on just the law.
Let's take another short break, and then we'll get back to our conversation with Lisa Huebner. She's a sociologist of gender, a feminist sociologist of gender at Westchester University, and the book that she wrote a couple of years ago called Catheters, Slurs, and Pickup Lines. Jacqueline Friedman joining us by Skype. She's a writer as well. Wrote a book a couple of years ago, Yes Means Yes, and she's got a new one, Unscrewed. And Noella Cabral is an educator, activist, an award-winning filmmaker, and she works with students teaching consent and gender-based and ending gender-based violence. And you can join our conversation by calling us at 1-888-477-9499. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne. We are talking about the Me Too campaign, the hashtag Me Too, that has gone viral in recent weeks. And again, talking with Noella Cabral, Jacqueline Friedman, and Lisa Huebner. And we have calls coming in at 1-888-477-9499. Got some comments, radiotimes@whyy.org. You can also tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Jacqueline, let me go back to you. I'm looking at something that Donna Karan, the fashion designer, said in response to some of the women that came forward accusing Harvey Weinstein of sexual harassment or even worse than that, basically suggesting that if you didn't dress so alluringly, perhaps he might have left you alone. Some other people have said that, including a representative, Eddie Bernice Johnson, a Democrat from Texas, saying the same thing. How are we supposed to understand what that message is to women?
I mean, that's a terribly dangerous and also false message to women, that you brought this on yourself, that there are decisions you can make that are your responsibility to prevent someone from hurting you, someone else from making an independent decision to treat you as subhuman. What's more, there's literally no research to support this. What we know from research with rapists is that they pick victims that they think are vulnerable, right? They pick targets who they think won't fight back, won't report them, won't make trouble for them. There's literally no social research to support the idea that rapists or predators, sexual predators, choose based on who, you know, most turns them on, because these are not acts of sexual incontinence. It's really important to understand this. This isn't about someone who just gets literally so turned on that they cannot physically control their body, right? If that were true of any of these people, they wouldn't be qualified to get in an elevator.
Right? I hear
Let
you.
Alone run a business. You know, Harvey Weinstein, these were planned out attacks, right? He set up fake meetings and got accomplices to help lure women in to make the meeting look legitimate, right? He met somebody and followed up. He knew what he was doing. And so that kind of advice is so damaging. It puts the onus on women. It lets the perpetrators off the hook, and it's completely false.
And it's about power and control.
It's absolutely about power and control. Also, if modesty was going to keep any of us safe, again, it would have done so already. You know, there are plenty of grandparents who've been sexually abused, you know, people who live in group homes, you know, like people in, you know, religions that are fundamentalist, that require sort of modest dress. Sexual assault and abuse happens in all of these communities. So modesty is not going to keep anybody safe. And saying that really actually only puts women in greater danger.
Noella, you want to add to that? And I'm thinking about people walking the street, wearing what they want to wear.
It comes up a lot in these workshops we've been doing. And, you know, students will say, well, if male students usually will say, well, if girls don't want to be treated like, you know, insert the word here, they shouldn't be wearing booty shorts, they shouldn't be wearing this. And so we spend a lot of time talking about victim blaming, and so we actually define it early on in the workshop. This is what victim blaming is. This is how it plays a role in rape culture, you know, blaming the victim, slut shaming. And so then when it comes up, we can say, thank you, you just, does everyone see how that's an example of victim blaming? Tell us why. And so we have a conversation about it. But yeah, we I agree. Modesty is not going to save us.
Well, I don't want to get off on a tangent here, but I'm thinking about the slut walks. We did a show about that when that really was a very much about taking back the streets and saying, I'm going to dress just the way I like. I don't know if you like the word slut walk or not, Noella.
It's not. I don't claim the word slut, but I support anybody who's trying to end rape culture, and I think that was an important piece of you know, the advocacy in recent years.
Lisa, anything you want to add to that?
Yeah, I think it is really important to have, you know, both community regulation and bystander intervention in the way we've been talking about, but also teaching all of us about that these are our bodies, we can do what we want with our bodies, and separate that conversation from any kind of, you know, factoring into how and when sexual assault or sexual harassment happens. It is a form of power. People do it to get power, and you can be wearing a suit, you can be wearing sweats, you can be wearing, it doesn't matter.
Let me read an email from Chris. Think about how this affects boys. Boys have to summon the courage to talk to girls and risk humiliation and rejection, which they get plenty of. How do you think that's going to shape their outlook? Girls learn pretty fast to be rude to guys and that they can make fun of them. They learn to be nasty, and that's part of the reason guys become aggressive. There, Jacqueline, I'm going to toss this to you. Obviously, my guests here in the studio, I would agree with this, do not agree with that caller or that commenter, but that's a very widely held belief.
Well, I think we have to rethink the entire heterosexual dynamic, right? And masculinity is part of it. We have to raise boys from the start to see girls as interesting and cool and three-dimensional, and to reframe the idea of heterosexual flirtation, or any flirtation really, but the question is very heterosexually framed, as one of collaboration instead of competition, right? We live in this culture where sexual interactions are conceived of as this sort of transaction where women give it up and men have to get some to prove their masculinity. And that's really tied up in this. But what if those interactions were just like, hi, I want to get to know you as a person, and, you know, yes or no, and like, and we just sort of like ratcheted down all those stakes that men and women weren't seen as opposing sides. So I just want to take like 100 steps back from the assumptions in that question.
Fair enough. Lisa, go ahead.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, I think when we sociologically study gender and we look at masculinity and femininity, we have to sort of be made aware that, first of all, masculinity is not a natural phenomenon. There's nothing on the Y chromosome that makes that happen. We create that. And part of how we create masculinity in a dominant way is actually what Michael Kimmel calls very fragile. Why are we so worried about boys risking? Why are we so concerned about boys fearing rejection? We all, as humans, fear rejection. We all risk. So I think we need to question how we define what it means to be a boy and what it means to be a man.
Although, can I add something? I'm sorry.
No, that's okay. I was going to add something too, but go ahead, Jacqueline.
I do think that what we need to do is teach boys emotional literacy so that if they experience rejection in that kind of an interaction, they can separate their identity from it, right? That it's not a rejection of them as men or as people, that they have the emotional literacy to say, "Ow, rejection feels bad. It feels bad for everybody. Maybe this person, this individual person, treated me poorly in this interaction," but it doesn't become about like a gender competition.
Well, and I think what's also interesting, Noelle, in this discussion is that we are so, in many ways, beyond the strictly male-female definition of what gender, even sexuality, is. There's so much that we have learned about the broad expression of people's sexuality.
For sure. Yeah. Yeah, and I think it's important for us as, you know, wherever we are on the spectrum, mm-hmm. Of sexuality, to be mindful that this is a very heterosexist world. But if we're really concerned about rape culture, we need to kind of check that frame, and just be mindful that rape and sexual assault happens to people across the sexual spectrum and across the gender spectrum, and it's really about dominance and power and toxic masculinity.
Let me read some more. Oh, yeah. Did you want to add something?
Just real quick. I think one common thread we can find in this when we see how it happens to people of all gender identity is the devaluing of femininity, the fear of looking like a woman or being like a girl. I think what we need to also do is uplift femininity.
Hmm. Let me read some more comments here from Jane, #MeToo. Comment from Cindy: I doubt it will reduce the threat, this Me Too campaign that's gone viral, but it will help victims feel empowered and aid in recovery. A comment from Regina: glad you're giving credit to the origins of the campaign, not celebrities. And that, of course, was the woman that started the campaign here in Philadelphia, Tarana Burke. She now works in New York and Brooklyn with Girls, as I understand it. Someone asks, how can we get men to hear us? Hopefully, men are listening and hearing us. A tweet from Cindy: it's time to have Congress pass the Equal Rights Amendment for women. And going on from there, an email from Breyer: it seems to me that this isn't so much a problem of masculinity, but a problem of enshrining more egalitarian rights, such as equal pay and stronger work protections, into our institutions and legal system. Which does raise the question, perhaps, Jacqueline, I can toss this back to you, since you talk about the system screwing us all, whether this really is, whether policies work. If you have policies that are put in place to deal with harassment, for instance, on the job, is that a sign of progress?
Good policy is better than lack of policy or bad policy, for sure. You know, I recently did a sexual harassment training with a pretty cutting-edge company that I was surprised to discover had only just instituted a sexual harassment policy, like, of any kind, right? Yeah. They hadn't had one on the books at all. So, absolutely. But policy is really only as good as the enforcement and whether or not people feel free to access that policy and what happens when they do access that policy. And I think the best way to think about changing a workplace culture is both on that sort of policy and practical HR level, but also on the leadership, C-suite, boardroom mm-hmm. level. And we do know that when you've got majority or near majority women in those echelons of power at a company, it does change the culture around sexual harassment. So these issues are all tied up. It's toxic masculinity, it's policy and law, but it's also about hiring discrimination, right? And fair pay. All of these things come to play in the workplace.
Do you agree, Lisa? Then we'll get John to join us.
I mean, I think it's important to note that many organizations, ever since sexual harassment became a crime, have imposed a zero tolerance policy, and it still occurs all the time in the workplace. I mean, certainly I saw it in the workplaces I studied as a part of my research. So I agree with Jacqueline that policy is helpful because it marks the occurrence, but access to recourse, paths to communication, I think what we can talk about is the same kind of bystander strategies could also be applied in the workplace. I think about my students who are working in bars and restaurants, and we talk about changing culture, and maybe management can put a sign that says, you know, this behavior is unwelcome here.
Let me get John from, looks like Ambler, to join us on Radio Times. Hi, John. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi, Marty.
Hi there.
I would like your guest to address what I believe is the conflation of terrible, egregious behavior with benign, innocent, and caring behavior. It seems that we've gotten this broad brush applied to so much innocent, benign behavior that has been conflated with this predatory nature of it. And it leaves very little room for a gray zone. And I've had my own experiences being indicted by an innocent, benign tap on the shoulder as an inappropriate touch. And the next thing I know, I was meeting with my HR person for inappropriate touching. It's the most benign thing, but yet this is the kind of problem I have with this conflation. Yes, there's awful, boorish behavior, but I think the vast majority of it, they had a woman who said, somebody complimented me how nice I look in the dress. And she said, use that as her example of sexual harassment. I would like them to address from the other perspective of what is not. What is not sexual harassment?
I hear you, John. I appreciate the call. Nuella, I know you want to respond.
You know, sexual harassment, when we talk about this in schools, a lot of students will say, well, you know, this is how we talk. I just want to tell her somebody she looks good, or, you know, and some women like it. And, you know, it's just a compliment, that kind of thing. And one of the things I think that's just really important to remember, John, is that, you know, for one woman, what might be received as a compliment for another woman might be totally unwelcome and make her feel uncomfortable. So, for example, you know, when I'm sitting in AutoZone trying to get new, you know, parts for my car, and a guy walks by me and says, sexy, you know, I'm uncomfortable. Like, I feel disrespected. I'm just trying to get something for my car. Can I go about my day? Someone else might receive that compliment differently. The issue is, you don't know how different women or different people are going to respond to that kind of attention or that behavior. And so I think it's best to just try to treat people like you would treat someone like yourself. If a guy is going to come up to you and tap your shoulder or comment on the your legs or something, obviously that would probably might make you feel uncomfortable. And so I just think it's important to be mindful also that you don't know the events that happened to that person even that earlier that day. And so when I'm walking down the street, you know, I might have been harassed three times already. And then maybe the fourth interaction is someone telling me I'm beautiful. And you know what? I might ignore it. Why? Because maybe two times before when someone told me I was beautiful and I said, thank you, the next question was, can I walk with you? Where are you going? What's your name? And just following in all of this. And so I want to encourage people to give women and folks, gender nonconforming folks, LGBT folks who are experiencing sexual harassment, sometimes on a daily basis, give us the benefit of the doubt. Mm. And sometimes your ego might be bruised, but it's most important to just not.
I hear you. Yeah. John, I appreciate that. Oh, we're almost out of time, Lisa, but it looks like you want to add something.
Just real quick. I mean, I think I appreciate your frustration, John, but I think it's really important not to frame this conversation as either innocent or predatory. I mean, what the reality is that these are mundane occurrences that happen all the time. When I'm told I look nice in a dress, when I'm teaching a class or giving a lecture, I don't want the attention to be on my dress or on my body. I want the attention to be on what I'm saying. So what seems benign might actually not be so benign.
Well, we could go on. They're playing my song, which means we have to end our show. Lisa Huebner, thanks for coming in. Thanks for joining us today on Radio Times. And Nuella Cabral, thank you for coming in as well. You're welcome. And Jacqueline Friedman, thanks for joining us by Skype.
Thanks so much.
You're welcome. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes and you can find out much more about the program. You can download a podcast of the show, find us on Facebook, and follow us on Twitter. Diana Martinez, the engineer for today's edition of the show, and it's produced by Debbie Builder, John Ahrens, and Trinae Nuri. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. Thank you for joining us.